and trading as a way to generate extra monthly income? Listen up. Before you sign up for some garbage program or awkward in-person seminar, you really need to hear about the online trader program that everyone's talking about. This is the program that allows you to get your account funded with someone else's money. That's right. Apiary Fund will gladly put up to $100,000 of their money into your trading account. And the best part? You get to keep 85% of the profits without putting in a dime of your own money. Apiary Fund and this program are growing like crazy. If you're looking for a way to generate extra income every month and finally learn how to win trades like the pros, just call 800-342-2968. Leave your email address on our voicemail, and we will send you all the exciting details of how to trade Apiary Fund's money and not your own. Call 800-342-2968. And again, just leave your email on our voicemail to get your free report on how you can trade someone else's money. Call 800-342-2968. That's 800-342-2968.
Hello, this is Alistair Begg inviting you to join me on a European tour this summer that includes a cruise down the scenic River Danube. We'll explore many historic sites where the Reformation took place 500 years ago, and we'll learn how the Reformation helps form our faith today. I hope you'll come along.
For more details on the Reformation Tour and River Cruise with Alistair Begg and to book your trip, visit kpdq.com.
Welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are, as usual, live with an open phone line inviting you to call in with questions you might want to ask about the Bible or the Christian faith or anything related thereunto. Or if you have a different viewpoint from the host and would like to call in to say so and explain why, we'll be glad to talk to you about that as well. The number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. And a few lines are open even now. And we've got a couple of our lines taken, but I'm waiting for the names of the callers to come up on the screen, and then I'll be taking those calls. I have an announcement to make about this Saturday. If you live in Southern California, we once a month on a Saturday night, we have a meeting in Buena Park, California. That is, of course, in Orange County. And we are going through the Bible one book per month. And what I'm doing is giving a thorough introduction and survey of each book of the Bible as we go month by month through the Bible. And then, of course, if you want to study with us, you can read that book after you've heard the introduction, and you'll be better equipped to make sense of it and to benefit from it. At least that's our aim. We've been doing this for some time. We're in the books of Chronicles this Saturday night. Now, you might think, Chronicles, that doesn't sound very interesting. Well, it does cover a lot of the same ground as Samuel and Kings, but not exactly the same ground. And it has its own unique features. And frankly, there are things about Chronicles that have made it probably one of the books of the Old Testament that has not been read through as many times as others have been, because it does seem to have some repetition of other books, and it also has some long lists and things like that. And so if you're hoping to read through the whole Bible and you haven't yet gone through Chronicles, join us Saturday night. That's this Saturday in Buena Park. We're meeting at the Way Fellowship in Buena Park. The address and the map can be found at our website, thenarrowpath.com, under the tab that says Announcements. All right, well, now our lines are almost full, so I'd better start talking to some of these people. Nader from Santa Cruz, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have encountered rational arguments from agnostics that complain that part of why they don't believe the Bible is that none of those people were alive when the Bible was written. I think they're referring to the New Testament. And, well, that stumps me a little bit. I can think of Paul right off the bat.
Right.
I don't know about the Gospels. How do you answer that argument?
Well,
I'll
take this off
the air.
Okay. I would say that a person who makes that argument is simply saying they reject the Bible without having done the slightest investigation into it because the information they have, they heard from someone equally uninformed as themselves, probably. To say that those people in the New Testament weren't alive when it was written, I dare say Paul was alive when he wrote his letters. He was also alive when Jesus was on the earth because he was contemporary with Jesus, although a little younger than Jesus. But he was contemporary. His life overlapped that of Jesus. And Paul knew the 12 apostles who had been with Jesus. He associated with them. They were his friends and associates. So obviously they were alive when he was writing. Peter wrote some letters. Peter was alive when he wrote. He didn't write posthumously. James and John also were alive when they wrote. In fact, essentially everyone in the Bible in the New Testament was alive when the New Testament was written, with the exception of a few people who died early. Judas, for example, who hanged himself before anything in the New Testament was written. The Apostle James was beheaded before anything in the New Testament was written. But apart from those two, Judas and James, all the other main characters in the Bible that I can think of that in the New Testament were still alive at the time, certainly of the writing of Paul's epistles. And Paul wrote more books of the New Testament than anybody else. And Paul himself gives us historical information about Jesus, though not as much as his friend Luke does. Luke wrote the book of Luke and the book of Acts, and he was a traveler with Paul, so he was obviously alive too. So it's very curious that anyone would say that the people were not alive when the New Testament was written. People who say that, they simply are saying, I've never done any research, and I probably don't want to do any. I just don't want to believe it. In which case, they're simply, that's another way of saying, I'm not intellectually honest. I just know what I want to believe. All right. So let's talk to another caller, this time Joey from Detroit, Michigan. Joey, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks for having me, Steve. God bless you.
Thank you.
I have my significant other, my girlfriend, she is trying to become a Catholic. And, I'm really excited because I've been a Catholic my whole life. But there are certain things that I'm not very well at articulating to someone that didn't grow up as a religious person in Christian faith and Catholicism. Now, the one thing that she's trying to do is she's trying to look at churches in her area that she could possibly, and we have a long-distance relationship going, so she is trying to find churches in her area right now that are going to work out for her for the time being because she really cares for my church. But I guess what I'm asking is it possible for someone to go to a church somewhere, not where they're going to get baptized, but still take all the classes to become a Christian or become a Catholic?
Now, before I answer that, what is your own faith position? Are you an evangelical or a Christian or an unbeliever? Or what are you?
I'm Roman Catholic.
I was born
a Roman Catholic.
Okay, so you're Roman Catholic, and she's considering becoming a Roman Catholic. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And she's taking classes from, what, a different denomination than Catholicism?
No, she's just taking them at a different Catholic church. And I guess my question is, if she were to take classes at a different church and get baptized at my church, does that usually present any issues? Or is it pretty easily fluid?
Yeah, it shouldn't because officially Roman Catholic churches all teach the same doctrine. I'm assuming that she's learning the doctrines of the Catholic Church in these classes, and those should be If she's learning them from a Catholic church, probably the same one she'd learn at your Catholic church if she took them. So I don't know what the Catholic Church policy is about that, because I'm not a Roman Catholic, and I have my disagreements with the Roman Catholic Church. But at the same time, I would think that two Roman Catholic churches would not have great disagreements with each other. And so I don't know what the Catholic Church's requirements are about that, but I would think that if she wants to join the Catholic Church, that it wouldn't matter which Catholic Church she took her catechisms at. I would think that any Catholic Church would accept the training offered by any other. But I don't know that for sure. There's certainly nothing. There's nothing in the Bible about any of this. This would all have to do with policies of the church. The institutional church, as it developed them beyond the time of Christ and the apostles. So,
So going back to my first part of the question really quick, she's asking about the Bible right now, and she's reading it, and she's actually just begun to start to read Genesis.
Uh-huh.
Now, how do I explain to her that these stories of when God... God does some punishing. How do I explain to her that same God is still as loving as in the New Testament, and is still as loving as the God that I know to be so loving, but with
sure.
with a firm love? Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, well, I mean, the way I see it is there's no contrast, really, between the nature of God as we see him in the Old Testament and the nature of God as we see him in the New Testament. In both descriptions, he's a very loving God and very merciful and very patient with sinners. But in both testimonies, he's also a judge who will judge sin as well. And this would be not, this is not, you know, schizophrenic. We, for example, there was a time when fathers used to discipline their children. You don't see that as much anymore, so we don't have that as something to measure against like we used to. But it was never understood to be contradictory for a father to love his children and protect them with his life and yet discipline them and punish them when they did wrong. In fact, the Bible says that a father who doesn't discipline his children doesn't love them. So biblical teaching about love does not suggest that God only does nice things and indulgent things toward people that he loves, but he also has to do harsh things at times if that's what's called for. Now, let me just say this. We might even move from the imagery of a father to that of a judge, because God also wears that hat in his universe. He's taken the obligation upon himself to maintain a just order in his universe. And a judge might be an extremely merciful man. He might be an affectionate father and husband and a very compassionate church member and philanthropist and all those things. And yet when it comes to sitting on the bench, when a condemned criminal is before him who deserves punishment, he gives him that punishment, because to do otherwise would be unloving, not to the criminal, but to the public. And this is the thing. We live at a time where punishing criminals is considered to be unkind, and it's only thought that way by people who are shallow thinkers. A murderer or a thief or anyone who victimizes other people or who's, ruining the neighborhood or ruining society by victimizing other people. If a judge doesn't do something about that person, take him out of circulation, then the judge is being unkind to everybody who's not a lawbreaker, all his potential victims. It's a loving thing for a judge to take out those who are doing harm to humanity in general. And therefore, when God judges somebody, he's acting in the role as a judge. But that doesn't contradict the fact that he's a loving God. And really, a lot of times people who died under some of the judgments of God, for example, in the flood or in Sodom and Gomorrah, for example, children no doubt died in those situations. And maybe a few decent people, not quite as evil as the rest, they all died. And we might say, well, that doesn't seem fair. But see, God has an option that we don't have. One reason we can't kill innocent people is because we can't do anything for them after that. But God has more to say about a person's destiny after they die. And if a person dies as a child or as an innocent person, well, then they are vindicated in eternity by God. But they simply get, you know, their short earthly life, which would have been cut short down to less than a century anyway, is now over, perhaps earlier than it might have otherwise been. But if God rewards them for eternity, then that's certainly more than a compensation for a shortened lifetime. So, I mean, God's judgment of the wicked, and even some of that overlaps because a whole society that's judged may also involve some people who aren't as wicked, like children. But God settles everything in a perfectly just and loving manner. The Bible affirms that very clearly, and Jesus demonstrates that. Although Jesus himself is seen to be rather harsh at times, and certainly in the New Testament, we do see God even striking people dead, just like he did in the Old Testament. So he hasn't really changed in the New Testament from what he was like in the Old. In both cases, we see God extremely patient toward sinners, impatient and very merciful, because even the worst of sinners, like David, who committed murder and adultery, two of the worst crimes recorded, God forgave him when he repented. And the worst king Israel ever had, or Judah ever had, was Manasseh. He did every kind of crime against God that can be committed, including the very worst. He sacrificed his children to a demon. And yet when he repented, God forgave him. So we see a God in the Old Testament who's inexplicably loving and forgiving and merciful to those who repent, but who's very understandably harsh on those who don't repent and whose continued careers, if they went on without interruption, would hurt many other people besides. So really, we have to see God as both the loving Father and the merciful judge, but a just judge. A judge may be a very merciful man, but that doesn't mean that he has the right to be unjust and let criminals walk when they deserve worse.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right. I appreciate your call. Thanks for joining us, Joey.
Yeah, thank you, too.
Mm-hmm. Bye now. All right. We're now talking to Pam from Portland, Oregon. Pam, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. Enjoy your show. My question concerns basically Luke the physician and his writing of the book of Luke and the book of Acts. He writes to Theophilus, and my mm-hmm. question concerns whether Theophilus is an actual person or if it's a coded name, since I was told it meant lover of God.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the meaning of the name Theophilus, lover of God. It comes from theos, which means God, and phileo, which means love. So Theophilus is simply a lover of God. And so some people have suggested that in addressing both the book of Luke and the book of Acts to this person, Theophilus, that Luke might not have anyone in particular in mind. He might be thinking of any lover of God. You know, now you've suggested that possibility, and some have thought that. Now, others have thought it's not likely that he's using it generically because turns out Theophilus was a fairly common proper name. In other words, even though it means lover of God, well, every name has some meaning, but it was actually a name that many people are known to have had in the first century in the Greco-Roman world. So since it is a common name, it's like if you wrote to me and addressed me as Stephen. Well, the name Stephen means crowned one. If someone was translating your letter into another language, they'd say, well, she's writing to a crowned one. Maybe she's writing to everyone who wears a crown. Well, probably not, since she used a name that's a very common proper name. It happens to mean that, but that's not the meaning. The meaning of the name is not what you're concerned about, but the individual you're writing to. And I think Theophilus was actually an individual. Many people think that Theophilus might have been a government official because in Luke chapter 1, Luke addresses him as most noble Theophilus. Now, that term, most noble, is actually a term that Paul used when he addressed Roman governors like Felix and Festus and Agrippa. Mm-hmm. And so it sounds like Luke might be writing to a government official. Some people think the government official in question could be, this is only a theory, but could be a government official that was assigned to investigate Paul's case, because these books were written, apparently, at least Acts was, when Paul was awaiting trial in Rome. And so there might have been a Roman official assigned by the emperor to preview the case, and Luke might have been writing these books to inform that official of, you know, the background of the case. That's a theory only. We don't know if it's true. No one knows for sure who Theophilus was because we don't have any outside information about who he was. Those are only theories that I've given you.
My reason for questioning it is like, you know, how we talk about Jane Doe or your John Hancock or things like that. Given that it's dangerous to write it was dangerous to write a letter to a Christian, particularly a Christian in a government profession, the question concerns whether some things are written in code. Not, I mean, to the extent that there is an actual person that is being written to, but a generic name is used to disguise that person for that person's safety.
It is. It's not impossible that that was the case. We simply don't. We don't really know. So we leave that as a theory that's possible. All right. Thank you for your call, Kurt from Santa Ana, California. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm wondering about an unrepentant sin of masturbation as it relates to the term sexual immorality in 1 Corinthians 6, 9.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you would consider that falling under that term porneia as it relates to that.
That's a very difficult question to answer biblically for the simple reason that the Bible does not actually mention masturbation by name anywhere. Now, when Paul lists a number of sexual sins, he sometimes includes, along with more specifically named sins, the word uncleanness. Now, I don't know what he means by uncleanness, especially when he's writing a list that includes things like adultery and fornication and bestiality and things like that. Of course, he doesn't mention bestiality per se, though the Old Testament does, but he does mention homosexuality and things like that. And then he also mentions, you know, uncleanness. Now, what in the world does he mean by uncleanness? Is he thinking of a mental uncleanness? Is he speaking of some behavior that is sexually unclean but doesn't have any of the names of the other sins that he's named? I don't know. We do know that in the Old Testament, if a man had a seminal emission in the night, that is, he had what we call a wet dream, he was considered to be ceremonially unclean, at least I think till the next night. And therefore, one might argue that for somebody to cause the same for themselves would be to impose a form of uncleanness as defined in the Old Testament lists of sins, sexual sins. So it is possible that fornication, which the Greek word porneia is a generic word for all forms of sexual misbehavior, could be thought to include masturbation. But, of course, that's only speculation. There's no absolutely clear reason to identify masturbation with uncleanness or uncleanness with masturbation. The term uncleanness does not mean masturbation per se. Whether Paul's referring to that act when he uses the term or not is speculative. But one could argue possibly that there is that possibility that Paul is thinking of that in that list. If he is not, then it's interesting that he lists as many sexual sins as he does, but never names masturbation among them. One could argue, well, that argues for uncleanness covering masturbation. Or one could argue that, some have argued, that means that masturbation is not regarded to be necessarily a sin because it's not listed with all the sinful behaviors, either in the Old Testament or the New Testament. And that being so, certainly we assume that the practice was around, both in Old Testament and New Testament times, that some would say, since Paul didn't name it, and Moses didn't name it, and Jesus didn't name it, that perhaps it's not regarded to be a sin in the same sense as the others. So that's why it's difficult to answer the question directly from the Bible. I've known pastors who have been who've actually advocated that young people who are having struggles with their, you know, sex drive actually go ahead. Now, I don't do that. I don't recommend that. But I've known pastors who did, because they felt like, well, maybe this is a God-given relief valve for, you know, unmarried people. And so all I say is that that is a view that I've heard out there more than once. And whenever I've spoken against masturbation, I have a number of times on the radio program and on our Bible forum, there's always quite a few Christian people who, you know, who contact me and say, no, you're wrong, and this is not a sin, and so forth. So what I would have to say is you're not going to get a unanimous answer from Christian authorities or even from the Bible itself, clearly, about that particular practice. So I would suggest another approach to the subject. Rather than look for that practice in a list of sins, why don't we take a more positive approach and ask, what does God intend for us to do with our sexuality? And if you look at 1 Thessalonians 4, beginning at verse 3, 1 Thessalonians 4, 3, and following, Paul says, "For this is the will of God, your sanctification," meaning you're being a holy person. He says that you should abstain from sexual immorality. There the word, of course, is fornication. He says that each of you should know how to possess his own vessel in sanctification and honor, not in passion of lust like the Gentiles who do not know God. Now, while we don't have masturbation mentioned in one of the lists in the Bible of sins, we do have a bar set for us in terms of management of our sexual pressures. And that is that we need to learn to possess our bodies in a way that's sanctified and honorable. Now, I remember hearing a preacher who was preaching against masturbation once say, does that seem like an honorable practice? Most people don't boast about it and would not really be all that eager for other people to learn of it. They'd find it to be somewhat embarrassing or shameful. And that being so, one could simply argue that it's not necessarily a practice that you feel honorable about or sanctified, like it doesn't feel holy. Now, someone might say, well, that's due to conditioning, social conditioning. I don't know that that's the case. I don't remember receiving any social conditioning about it when I was growing up. The truth is, I was led a pretty sheltered life and didn't even know what it was until I was a young adult, which is, may seem amazing. But I never practiced it, never heard of it. Well, I may have heard the term, but I didn't even know what it meant until I was a young adult. And I have to say that I didn't receive any social conditioning against it particularly, but nonetheless, when I learned of it, it didn't seem to me like an honorable or holy practice, but that's subjective. I would say that when it comes to a thing that the Bible does not name outright as a sin, you really need to walk in the Spirit about that and ask yourself, is this exhibiting the fruit of the Spirit of self-control? If I'm walking in the Spirit, then I won't fulfill the lust of the flesh, and I need to let the Spirit guide me in terms of things that are otherwise ambiguous. And that's about the most I can say on biblical authority about this particular matter, because there isn't anything more specific. I kind of wish there was, because there are a great number of people who certainly want to know the answer to your question. I'd say walk in the Spirit and you'll know what to do. You can always repent if you decide that it was a sin that you did it, but you don't want to keep doing things that you know to be sin that you have to repent of. We're going to take a break here for just about 30 seconds. We'll come back and take more calls, so don't go away. The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. You can also donate from our website, thenarrowpath.com. Stay tuned for 30 seconds. We'll be right back.
As you know, the Narrow Path radio show is Bible radio that has nothing to sell you but everything to give you. So do the right thing and share what you know with your family and friends. Tell them to tune in to the Narrow Path on this radio station or go to thenarrowpath.com, where they will find topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all the radio shows. You know, listeners supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Share what you know.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live for one more half hour today. We're on every day for an hour. This is our second half of the show. And if you'd like to be on the program, we have an open phone line for you to call with questions about the Bible or questions about the Christian faith or the Christian life. If you have those questions, you can raise them for discussion. If you have a difference of opinion with the host, you can raise that for discussion, too. The number to call, in any case, is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. All right, our next caller today is Mark from Idaho. Mark, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you, Steve. I used to listen to you in the Citrus Heights, California area, and we moved up here a year ago, and I was traveling the dial and ran into you and went right on. So
great.
Yeah, I was actually kind of excited. It's interesting that up here we founded a little Baptist church, and in that church our pastor is a postmillennialist, and our assistant pastor is a premillennialist.
Oh,
so
that's unusual.
I find it wonderful that that they get along and still have that single focus of bringing people to Christ in spite of their opinions.
That does sound like a healthy situation, yeah.
Yeah, it's very interesting, and they're extremely amicable. There's no hard feelings at all. It's just they disagree. But
yeah.
My question is, the pastor actually handed me a book called Victory in Jesus, The Bright Future of Postmillennialism or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I started reading into it, and unfortunately the guy that was writing, he gets a little defensive right off the bat. So the spirit there is a little bit, I don't know, maybe even self-centered. I'm not quite sure. I haven't gotten deep enough into it.
Uh-huh.
But the other day I was reading, and unfortunately I'm having to drive. The only time I ever get to listen to you is when I'm on the road, and I can't really look up the Bible verses while I'm driving. But there's a section in 2 Thessalonians where Paul is talking about how Christ will not return until A, B, C, D, E, and F happen. And I wondered how you view that, because I may be mistaken, but from what I've heard you talk about before, you tend to believe that a lot of the stuff with the Antichrist and all that happened back in around 70 A.D., correct?
Well, I believe that many of the passages that popularly applied to the Antichrist, like Revelation 13, do not await a future fulfillment. I do believe
right.
that I don't believe necessarily that the man of sin in 2 Thessalonians 2 is necessarily identified with the beast of Revelation 13.
Oh,
most people do, but nonetheless, I do believe that Nero was certainly a manifestation of the beast. I believe there are other manifestations of the beast throughout history, but I believe that Nero was certainly the contemporary manifestation of the beast in the time when Revelation was written.
Okay, so just to get this straight, I want to make sure, because I tend to believe that even though there may be a prophecy that has absolutely and completely been fulfilled, and there's no question about it, it doesn't necessarily mean that it won't be fulfilled again at a later time for God's purpose, correct?
Well, that depends on a number of things, too. I mean, it depends on if it's a one-time event or if it's a repeated event. For example, there's a prophecy that says the Messiah would be born in Bethlehem in Micah 5:2. If that happened,
right.
It's not going to happen again. There's a prophecy
right, over
in Zechariah 9. It says that the Messiah is going to ride into Jerusalem on a donkey. He did that, too, and that's not going to happen again. I mean, in other words,
right.
there are lots of prophecies that only have one fulfillment. There are other prophecies in the Bible that have, it would appear, what I call a typological fulfillment. That is, they have an actual fulfillment in history, but that fulfillment is a type and a shadow of something further out in the future. And
yeah,
therefore,
okay.
Yeah, so
okay.
Now,
that makes it a little easier. And I've always wanted to get it right, but at the same time, I know that energy is better spent in introducing people to Jesus than spending too much arguing, on that kind of thing. So, but I do appreciate you being out there to give me something to think about and all your study, and I'll continue to. Hey, man.
Okay, great to hear from you, Mark. Thanks for calling. Hope you enjoy Idaho. I used to live in Idaho. Let's talk to Bruce from Beaverton, Oregon. I used to live in Oregon also. Hi, Bruce. Welcome.
Steve, you lived in a lot of places. Good to talk to you. I want to focus on Daniel 9, verses 25 and 26. I think I'm finally starting to get the 70 times 7 concept. But in these two verses, it's very clear in 25 what's being said. And the language is something like 62 sevens and then 7 sevens. And, you know, we can all add that up. That's 69 sevens, and that's 483. That works.
Yep.
But then in verse 26, it's something like 62 and 7 sevens.
No, that's not what it says. Let me clarify that, because I think you read verse 25 differently, and that may have confused you about verse 26. In verse 25, it says, from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem until the Messiah, the Prince, there shall be 7 sevens and 62 sevens. And then verse 26 says, and after the 62 sevens, the Messiah will be cut off. Now, the 62 sevens are the 62 sevens mentioned in the previous verse, which followed the first 7 sevens. So, in other words, when you read about after the 62 sevens, it's really after 69 sevens have passed, because there were 7 of them before the 62. And now after the 62, there's going to be one more.
Say that again. I'm not following that. I got the first part.
Okay.
Okay.
There's a total of 70 sevens. They are broken down into 3 segments. 7, then 62, then 1. Okay, if you add that up, that's 70. Now he says there'll be 7, and then there'll be 62. And after the 62, there's some other things, which obviously will be in the last, because the 62 began after the first 7. So once he talks about after the 62, we've already got those 62 and the previous 7 behind us. So you've had 69 of the 7s done. After the 62, that's really after 69. And now you've got the 70th.
Okay, read verse 26. That'll help us.
Okay. And after the 62 7s, the Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end of it shall be with a flood.
And so it said after the 62 sevens, which to me, I don't see how you get around. I mean, I'm struggling with that.
I'm not really sure what the problem is. Let me see if I can say it again real slow. Okay? There are 7 sevens.
Right.
Then there are, after that, 62 sevens.
Right.
That's 62 more than the 7. Right?
It's a total of 69.
Right. And then after that, after the 62,
now
there's the last
five. We're in verse 26 now, right?
Yeah, verse 26 says after the 62 sevens.
Okay.
So you've had two groups of sevens before. You've had a group of 7 sevens and a group of 62 sevens.
Okay.
And after the second group, after the 62 sevens, there's another 7.
And that last 7, that's the infamous gap, right?
Well, the dispensationalists see a big gap there. They believe that after the 62, which is really after 69 of the 7s,
right,
you have a gap. And that the 70th 7 remains, they believe, to be fulfilled at the end of time and will be identified as the tribulation. The last 3.5 years of it, they call the Great Tribulation, but the whole 7 years they call the Tribulation.
Right.
Now, this assumption is the entire case in the Bible for there being a 7-year tribulation. There's no mention. There's no mention of a 7-year tribulation anywhere in the Bible. But because dispensationalists believe that the 70th week, which is 7 years, is to be identified with the tribulation Jesus spoke of in Matthew 24:21, then there shall be great tribulation. They say, okay, then the tribulation that Jesus spoke of is 7 years because it's Daniel's 70th week. Now, I don't believe that Daniel's 70th week, it doesn't mention it being a tribulation at all. And it certainly doesn't mention it being at the end of time. It happens, as far as anyone could calculate, immediately after the 69 weeks. After all, the 62 weeks happened immediately after the 7. Everyone agrees with that. You've got 7. then you've got 62. But no one sees a gap between the 7 and the 62. And then you've got one more after the 62. No one should see a gap between this, you know, the 69th week and the 70th. But there's none there. There's none hinted at. There's none suggested.
Right.
There's nothing there you can do with the Hebrew to make it work. It's simply a dispensational assumption that because they don't like to believe that this prophecy has been fulfilled back in the first century, which it was, and which it, a literal interpretation would say it was. You know, they don't want that. They want it to be fulfilled in the end of the world, but they know that the first 69 weeks came to an end in the life of Jesus. So they say, okay, the 69th week ended, they would say, on Palm Sunday, when Jesus rode in Jerusalem, and the 70th week was postponed for nearly 2,000 years. Then the 70th week would come. Now, this postponement of the 70th week for 2,000 years, that's a significant postponement. You'd think there might be a hint of it there somewhere. There's not the slightest hint of it.
What do you do, and I think I know, but might as well share with the listeners, what do you do with that 70th week? How do you absorb that?
Well, Jesus, I believe, came at the end of the 69th week and was baptized. His baptism was at the end of the 69th week. And therefore, his ministry began at the beginning of the 70th week. Now, it says in the midst of the week, that's 3.5 years, he will cause the sacrifices and offerings to cease. Well, what was it that brought an end to the sacrifices and offerings but the death of Jesus? And that happened in the midst of the week. That is 3.5 years after his baptism, he was crucified, and that brought an end to the sacrificial system as far as God is concerned. Certainly the Jews didn't recognize Jesus, so they kept doing the sacrifices until the temple was destroyed in AD 70. But as far as God was concerned, it was done. He brought an end to the validity of the sacrifices with his own death by being the final sacrifice for sin. So in the middle of that week, 3.5 years, he ends the system of sacrifices. Also, it says, of course, in verse 26, that he is cut off. That means he's killed. Okay, so Jesus' death takes place after 69 and a half of the sevens. There's a half of the seven, 3.5 years left. Now, what are these sevens for? They are for, it says, the people of Israel. It has to do with God's dealing with the people of Israel, it says. He says 70 sevens are determined for your people, Daniel. That's the Jews. And for your holy city, that's Jerusalem. So Jesus is cut off in the middle of the 70th week. Then there's 3.5 years left to deal with. One view holds that there is a gap. I don't take this view necessarily, but some people think there's a gap of less than a generation, and the remaining 3.5 years is the Jewish war and the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. The war began in 66 and ended in 70. I think it probably more likely that the remaining 3.5 years was that period of time after the crucifixion of Christ, when God still was dealing exclusively with the Jews, because these 70 weeks have to do with God's dealing with the Jews, Daniel's people. And even though Jesus died for the sins of the world, Gentiles were not evangelized in the first years of the church. We don't know exactly when Paul's conversion took place. It could easily have been 3.5 years after the death of Christ, but Paul was the first apostle who was specifically set apart exclusively to reach Gentiles. And his call would certainly mark the end of God dealing exclusively with the Jews.
Yeah. That really helps a lot. And, you know, all the tribulation language, you know, that takes you back to 70 AD and so forth, right?
Well, yeah, as you can imagine, I have a lot of callers waiting. And also...
Steve, thanks so much. That's great.
Okay, Bruce, thanks for your call. Anyone who would like a detailed treatment of this, of the 70 weeks, or of any of the eschatological questions, the Antichrist, the tribulation, the rapture, the millennium, any of that stuff, is free to go to my lectures, which are free to listen to online. You just go to thenarrowpath.com. That's our website, thenarrowpath.com. And if you go to the tab that says Topical Lectures, you'll find a drop-down menu of a whole lot of series of topical lectures I've given, and one of them is called When Shall These Things Be? Because the series are listed alphabetically, it's near the end of the listing. When Shall These Things Be? And look at that. Look at the titles of the lectures. You'll see what they're about, the rapture, the tribulation, and millennium, and so forth. And in my lectures, I go into enormous detail, scripturally, to discuss both the dispensational view and the non-dispensational view. I also have some lectures just on the 70 weeks of Daniel, which can be found in our series on What Are We to Make of Israel. By the way, for those of you who've tried to listen to links at our website and found them broken in the past 2 or 3 months, we've been very much aware of it. We've been they are repaired. I'm just informed today, I think, if you find one that isn't, please let me know. But I believe, see, we had the entire Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, all those lectures were not available for a couple of months because the links got broken. They're working now. And so if you've tried to listen to any of those lectures at our website in the past few months and been frustrated, hopefully you will not be frustrated if you go there now. We have, of course, verse-by-verse teachings through the Bible at our website, and we have hundreds of topical lectures, and all of them are free. And so the series I just mentioned was called When Shall These Things Be? It's a very thorough 14-lecture treatment of eschatological subjects. All right, we have another Detroit caller. By the way, I received a donation from a listener in Detroit, and now we've had two calls today from Detroit. I'm glad to be hearing so much from our Detroit area. Hi, Wally. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Thank you. I love your show. I had a question about Matthew 23:8. It says, you shouldn't be called rabbi because your teacher, one is your teacher.
Yeah.
And in the epistles, it says that one of the callings is teaching.
Yeah.
And it seems like it's a contradiction that that what Jesus said about not calling anyone your teacher and having a calling or ministry of teaching seems contradictory. Can you explain
well,
that?
Well, we can either say it's contradictory or we can assume it's not and find out what it means. Because certainly the language can be understood reasonably without a contradiction. When Jesus is talking about not calling anyone teacher, it's in the context of calling people by religious titles, honorary titles, which he said the scribes and the Pharisees love to have these titles. It says in verse 6, they love the best places, the feasts, and the best seats in the synagogue, and the greetings in the marketplace, and they love to be called by men, rabbi, rabbi, which means teacher, teacher. And then Jesus says, but you, speaking to his disciples, don't be called teacher. Don't be called rabbi. For one is your teacher, the Christ. You're all brethren. Do not call anyone on earth your father. For one is your father, he who is in heaven. And do not be called teachers. For one is your teacher, Christ. Now, he says the term father and the term teacher were terms that he didn't want his disciples being called. But he's referring to that in the context of how the rabbis wanted to be called teacher and rabbi and father. In other words, as honorary titles. There's, for some reason, religions like to give labels to their leaders that signify status. And Jesus says immediately after that, he says, but whoever is greatest among you shall be your slave. The point is, you're not supposed to be seeking status. That doesn't mean there's no one who teaches. It certainly doesn't mean that there's no one who's a father. There's, you know, I'm a father, I have children. I mean, when he says, don't call anyone on earth your father, he doesn't mean don't call your own dad father. He means don't give people religious titles, like father or rabbi or whatever, which are simply ways of showing some kind of honor to them as if they're better than other men. He says, The best of you is the one who's the slave of all. So he's not saying the word father or the word rabbi or the word teacher are taboo. If you're talking about your real dad, you can call him father. If you talk about someone who's really teaching, you can describe them as one who teaches or as a teacher. But if you're giving them an honorary title, this would be against the spirit of what Jesus is saying, I believe. And that's why I would disagree with the Catholic practice of calling the Pope or the priest father. Because the Pope and the priest, by definition, are not fathers. They're not even married. They don't have children. At least they're not supposed to have children because they're not married. But the truth is, that's just an honorary title they give them. But if I call my dad father, it's because he really is my dad. It's not an honorary title per se. It's a descriptive title. If I say, hey, I want you to call me teacher or pastor or reverend or rabbi, well, then I'm in violation of what Jesus is talking about. If someone says, what do you do? And I say, I'm a teacher. That's just describing what I do. I'm not asking for that to be a label or a title. So Paul does talk about people being teachers and even fathers. He says to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians, he says, you have many instructors, but not many fathers. He says, I have begotten you in the Lord. He says, I'm like your spiritual father. But that wasn't even being used as an honorary title. It was a real title. He did bring them to life in Christ. He preached the gospel. He's their spiritual father. A priest in a Catholic church usually didn't lead his congregation to Christ, and therefore he's not, in a real sense, their father at all. So we're talking, there's a difference between calling someone father, rabbi, teacher, or whatever, as a job description or as a reflection of reality that is not expressed better by any other words than that. It's talking specifically about how the scribes and Pharisees love to have these honorary titles because that makes them feel better than other people. And Jesus said, you don't want to be that. You want to be less than other people. You want to be a slave of all, not someone who everyone fawns on and calls, you know, respectful titles.
I see. Thank you.
All right. I appreciate it.
I also think that one of your callers last week was wrong and they were saying that they didn't think Trump was a Christian, but I think he's demonstrated many things that I think are awesome, like Neil Gorsuch as a Supreme Court justice. I'm sure there's other things in there, but I know that some people struggle with Trump, but
sure.
I think he's a changed man.
Like I said, I never said he was or was not a Christian. I don't know the man. And, you know, there are people I know who seem to be Christians. I'm not sure if they're Christians or not. You know, lots of people live kind of like a Christian, and it's hard to tell. So I've never tried to decide whether Trump's a Christian or not. But when our caller said that he definitely isn't a Christian because he's not humble, as I said, there's unfortunately too many Christians who aren't as humble as they should be. And those who are may have other defects. Christians often have defects. But I don't know if he's a Christian or not, but I couldn't decide that he's not because he's not as humble as I wish he was. I appreciate your call, brother. Thank you for joining us today. Let's talk to Paul from Kansas City, Missouri. Paul, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve, how you doing?
Good.
Good, good. Hey, I wanted to ask you a question. I've been just kind of in Proverbs lately and just kind of going through knowledge and wisdom and understanding. And I think I got like a layman's understanding, but I want to understand the word understanding more, I guess. So knowledge being, you know, the apprehension of facts, and wisdom is the application of knowledge to a desired end. Then what would understanding be, like a layman's definition to that?
Well,
it says get wisdom and get
right.
With your wisdom, get understanding.
Right. You're in the Proverbs, you'll often find Solomon extolling these different academic and intellectual traits, wisdom, understanding, discernment, discretion, knowledge. These are all terms that are bandied about, and they're coupled in different verses, you know, discretion and wisdom, or knowledge and understanding, or, you know, it seems like he's just got a bunch of words that, in some senses, he's using almost interchangeably and grouping them randomly. Whenever he says discretion, he probably means all the other things in that list. Whenever he says wisdom or understanding, he's probably referring to the whole package because he doesn't seem to show, discrete separate meanings for these words in his usage. It is true that knowledge technically is simply the apprehension of facts or the acquisition of facts or information. Wisdom, as you mentioned, it would be knowing how to apply those facts. Discretion, discernment, understanding, these are all also words that, understanding would simply mean that you're seeing, you're not only being told a certain thing that's obscure, but you're seeing, you're grasping it, basically. You're grasping, you're seeing through the information to the nature of the thing. You're grasping it. As if somebody was trying to explain to me how to, fix my computer, which is something I don't know anything about. They could talk, and I might not grasp it at all. I mean, they could talk all day, and yet if I don't have the frame of reference for understanding how a computer works, I may not be gaining understanding at all. But that person understands it because he knows the nature of the thing. He's he grasps it fully. And understanding, therefore, would be something, you know, like knowledge. It'd be knowledge that has been fully grasped. But I don't know that Solomon, when he uses all these different terms, is, you know, if you sat down and said, okay, could you give me an exact definition of knowledge as opposed to understanding, as opposed to discernment, as opposed to discretion, as opposed to wisdom, can you give me a specific, you know, discrete definition of each of these? He might say, I don't know. I hadn't really given it that much thought. I just think that you really need to seek to understand and know what's real and what's godly and how you should live. And all those words, I think, are, in his mind, aspects of it. And I would suspect from the way I read him using those words that the borders of their boundaries, I should say the boundaries of their definitions, are a little fuzzy because they certainly are overlapping domains, some of those words.
Good enough. And if you got time for one more question, I don't know if you got somebody else waiting. I can let it go.
Oh, Paul, I would have. I would have. But the music just started. That means I don't have time. I'm off here in about a minute. But if you want to call back tomorrow, I'll be glad to take your second question. And the same thing for Tabitha in El Dorado Hills, California. I wish I could take your question, but I'm out of time. So if you could call back tomorrow, I'd be very happy to talk to you about those things. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. As I said before, the Narrow Path is listener-supported, and you can write to us at the Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. You can also donate from the website if you want to, though the website has hundreds of resources that you can download for free. There's nothing for sale at the website. Everything's free. But if you want to donate, you can at thenarrowpath.com. We'd love to have you do so. That'll help us stay on the air. God bless you. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow.
The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg is sponsored by The Narrow Path every weekday at 2 o'clock here on True Talk 800. Coming up, we have some Bible teaching from Pastor Ron Mell next in Heart of the Word. And then we have On the Bright Side.
State Farm, Robert here.
Robert, somebody burned down my she shed.
No one burned down your she shed, Cheryl.
Oh, really, Victor? Because my she shed's burning up in the backyard.
Your she shed was struck by lightning, Cheryl.
Robert, does State Farm cover my she shed?
What's a she shed?
She turned our shed into her hideaway, Robert.
Oh, yeah, that's covered.
You hear that, Victor? I'm getting a new she shed.
Can we stop seeing she shed now?
Go with the one that's here to help life go right. State Farm. Talk to an agent today.
With Bobby Bollinger.
Securities offered through Madison Avenue Securities, LLC, MAS, member FINRA and SIPC, MAS, Northwest Financial, and Tax Solutions are not affiliated companies. You've worked hard, and now it's time to make sure nothing comes in the way of having the retirement you've always dreamed of. Join best-selling author, financial educator, and radio show host, Jeff Dixon, the Retirement Coach, every Monday afternoon at 1, right here on True Talk 800. Jeff can help take guesswork out of your retirement planning. Tune in this Monday afternoon at 1 for the Jeff Dixon
Pros and the Know start with Lowe's, because Lowe's saves pros money toward their bottom line when they shop during our Cobalt Tool Savings event. Stop in today for great deals like up to 35% off select Cobalt tools and tool storage, including our Cobalt 24-volt max half-inch drive brushless cordless impact wrench kit, now for just $199. So, pro, now that you know, let's get started. Offer valid through 7/9 while supplies last. See store for details. U.S. only.
Show. When it comes to certain jobs, you're only as good as your tools. Honda's 4-Trax Rancher line of ATVs are exactly the tools you want. Every rancher starts with the same proven Honda engine, a 420cc workhorse with fuel injection. You can also choose between independent rear suspension or one of the swing arm models. Just head to Motorsport Hillsboro, located at 809 Northeast 28th, and check out the new 2018 Honda 4-Trax Rancher lineup. Honda recommends the Rancher for riders 16 years and older, and recommends that all ATV riders take a training course.
A young, passionate monk and theologian strides up to the imposing dark doors of Castle Church in Wittenberg, Germany. The year is 1517. The thick Gothic steeple towers above. Quietly, Martin Luther posts a list of 95 statements challenging the Roman Catholic Church. That document set in motion the events of the Reformation and changed the Christian faith forever. In 2018, you too can step in front of those very church doors, along with teaching pastors Dr. Alistair Begg. Join Alistair and fellow like-minded believers for the Reformation Tour and River Cruise July 31st through August 12th. Visit fascinating historical sites that played an integral role in the Reformation, including charming European villages. So book your trip today and join teaching pastor Alistair Begg for the Reformation Tour and River Cruise July 31st through August 12th, 2018.
For all the details, visit TrueTalk800.com or call 855-565-5519.
KPDQ Portland, a service of Salem Media Group. True Talk 800 is your home for Linfield Wildcats football.
True Talk 800, KPDQ.
It's just after 3 o'clock and time for Heart of the Word with Pastor Ron Mell on True Talk 800.
People can't walk in victory, and people can't overcome until they're born again. Have to be born again. I need the power of Jesus Christ.
Welcome to Heart of the Word, presented by Compassion Ministries, founded by Pastor Ron Mell. Hello, this is David Harms. Thanks for joining us here on the broadcast today. So here's a question to start out the broadcast. Have you ever taken a shortcut that didn't quite work out? Well, if you are a licensed driver, you probably have had that particular experience, but not just in driving.